Services, Calvin Hammond in From the Front Line. In this program, we are seeking to explore the serious repercussions of the lockdown that has been put in place in South Africa and in many other countries in the world, affecting more than 3.5 billion people. Dad, why is this even being put in place? Why does the government have the right to overrun our Bill of Rights, the freedom of movement, the freedom of conscience, the freedom of religion, and the freedom of worship?
Well, it's just disturbing because obviously we want to be responsible citizens. We want to love our neighbor. We want to do to others. We want to be done unto. Hygiene's a good idea. Wonderful that there's an emphasis on washing hands, cleaning everything, including the railings in buses and trains. And we're not against every hygiene practice taken. Of course, if you're sick, you should stay at home. You should infect others, should be in quarantine, isolation if it's infectious disease. And social distancing is wise, particularly in a time when there's an epidemic. But it's deeply disturbing when a government can lock down a country. And we have bills of rights. Magna Carta, as the grandfather of all bills of rights, 1215. The American Bill of Rights. South Africa's got a Bill of Rights. There's laws in countries that seek to restrain government. We need to remember that the whole purpose for constitutions is not for the people, it's for the governments. It's to restrain and restrict government from getting out of hand. Because historically, governments have not been the solution, they've been the problem. Just in the 20th century alone, which has been the century of secular humanism, the century of the gangster states, of socialist, secular states such as the Soviet Union, Red China, you've had vast amounts of people murdered. In fact, according to Death by Government, Professor Rummel calculates 265 million people killed by governments in the 20th century alone, of which the Soviet Union killed over 66 million, Red China over 69 million. Horrific destruction caused by governments. And so governments need to be, in the words of Thomas Jefferson, chained down by the chains of the Constitution. So the government restricts, is meant to be restricted by the Constitution, by the Bill of Rights.
Do we even have a Constitution in this country?
We do. And we've got a Bill of Rights. And it's meant to be taken seriously. And amongst the Bill of Rights in South Africa is that freedom of worship, freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly, freedom to protest, freedom of dissent, freedom of movement and of association. All these freedoms are guaranteed by a Bill of Rights. And yet what's disturbing is in the wake of the worldwide panic about the pandemic, and let's bear in mind that when people say the coronavirus has caused this and this, not actually. The coronavirus has caused a certain amount of infections, of which most of the people have already recovered, and a certain amount of deaths. Not more than the common flu kills on a given year. Not even close. And bear in mind, if you want to keep things into perspective, 1.5 million people die each year from tuberculosis. 9 million people die each year from cancer. And when it comes to car accidents, 1.3 million die every year from car accidents. So this reaction to the coronavirus may be overreaction, but it's unprecedented in the history of the world to have 3.5 billion people in lockdown, to have entire economies in shutdown, to have people confined to homes and have churches not meeting because the government said you cannot. This is so disturbing because the implications are that instead of healthcare, we've got a health scare. Mm. Instead of government seeking to protect its people and observe the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, what we seem to have now is governments that are jumping on opportunity to have far greater power than they've ever had in their lives. I mean, power to just look what's happened in South Africa. We've had police and army going around arresting people for what could not be considered a crime. You know, people trying to surf, trying to jog, people trying to go to the shop to buy some aspirin for their child who's running a fever, getting arrested and the family not seeing them since. People getting beaten up even in on their doorstep by army and police. And this has been filmed and documented, the things going on. So the trouble is there's always abuse. Individuals can abuse their powers. And that's why there's laws, constitutions, bills of rights, and you're not meant to use the military in anything but defense of the country. So when the military are coming in doing what the police should be doing, it's a sign that there's something radically wrong. Military are not trained in law. Military are not trained in rights. Military are trained to kill people who are a threat to the country. So when you deploy the National Defense Force in towns and suburbs, what do you think is going to happen? If they meet any kind of resistance, they're not inclined to, well, where does this fit in with the Bill of Rights? And what are they're not thinking legal. They're thinking, well, the only thing they've actually been trained to do is to shoot at people things like this. So it's not wise to unleash soldiers, armed soldiers. We're not talking about there's a national disaster and helping to rescue flood victims. You're talking about where you're telling people they're not allowed to leave their homes.
And if they do, they get arrested.
Yeah, but in many cases, as we've seen on the news, they're not getting arrested. In many cases, they're getting beaten up, which it cannot be the job of a soldier to walk into a town and start smacking people, hitting people, smacking them in the face with rifle butts, taking bottles that they bought for the store, smashing them on the ground. Well, what's this going to do? First of all, who's going to pick up the glass? Somebody walking around there can cut their feet. This is just on so many levels unhelpful. But you mustn't blame just the police or army who are only following orders after all, but the governments that ordered it. And when people say this is done by the coronavirus, that's not actually true.
It's just the reaction.
Correct. Life is 10% what happens to you and 90% how you react to it. And in this case, we have a government that said that this is necessary and this is essential that we have a lockdown. But of course, not everyone agrees.
And then what about the comparison to Sweden and how their neighboring countries, Norway and Finland and such, they're having lockdowns, but Sweden, they're not having any sort of restrictions. They are abiding by social distancing and higher hygiene levels, but their economy seems to be going perfectly.
Yes, so not every country has gone for a complete lockdown. We've had examples of many countries that have gone very extreme, like South Africa's following the example of Red China and of India. And India, we've seen some horrific pictures of them.
We are
literally whipping the
people, beating the people,
and millions of people, poorest people who don't really have homes or work, are pouring together, and you've never seen such a crush of humanity, fleeing the towns where they can't get work because everything's shut down, trying to flee to the countryside. And so you've got millions of people crammed together in India in a way worse than has ever been seen even before. So their restrictions have actually caused a greater rate of infection probably than would have happened if they had no restrictions. But then you've got other countries like Sweden who've decided very carefully, very thoughtfully, looking at their medical experts, even though they're surrounded by countries that have lockdowns, and the Swedish government has said, we do not see the need for any government intervention. The people are responsible. The people know about the dangers. They know how to counteract it. They understand how coronavirus works and how it spreads and what they need to do to prevent it. You cannot legislate against the disease, they said. This is something for every individual citizen to take responsibility for, and they are not convinced that they have a higher rate of infection than other countries. They're not convinced that they have a higher rate of death. They're not convinced that they see any greater spread of the disease than in those countries that has a total lockdown. So the entire economy in Sweden's carrying on. They're not banning sports events. They're not banning people from continuing to meet in churches. Restaurants are still open, but they are practicing. They've always had a high standard of hygiene in Sweden anyway,
but Sweden itself is an extremely high level first world country.
Yes.
How could you put that comparison to a third world country like South Africa and the implications of a lockdown? What are the negative effects?
Okay, well, in fact, over here, the trouble is that instead of letting people walk in the park or hike in the mountains or jog along the canal, or anything else that is actually healthy and getting outside and getting some sunlight, which has proven to be an effective way of fighting the coronavirus. People are being told to stay in their home, which in many cases is an apartment or a flat or a shack, and they don't have access to a garden or to sunlight if they don't go out into a park and so on. So what you've got here is, as it's been proven, a lockdown in South Africa, like they've spoken about in China and other countries world, is not workable in South Africa, not for the majority of the population.
Yeah.
And so when you've got a first world and a third world economy living side by side, what you're getting is a portion of the country is observing this lockdown, but the bulk are not observing the lockdown. And so the lockdown in South Africa has proved to be ineffective and unenforceable. And in some cases where the army has been patrolling, like in Alexandra Township, we had news reporters out there showing how The people are openly ignoring it. Mm. People are gathering by the tens of thousands in groups and just shouting at the police, throwing rocks at the police and army, and not interested in moving out the way at all. And so plainly, the bulk of the population of South Africa are not observing the lockdown. So if it's not effective, why apply it?
But even on the actual lockdown, you know, I went shopping yesterday and I was seeing longer queues and more people in the shops than ever before, as they are now limited to certain times and certain shops. And you now have people stock buying, panic buying, and you have more people in the shops than before.
Meaning that people could be infecting themselves more in the queues for essential supplies than if we didn't have a lockdown.
It's condensed shopping. And
so actually people on many cases are literally breathing down one another's necks.
Yes.
So it can be counterproductive. And we should look at some other examples, because the idea that this is the only model lockdown, it isn't. South Korea, Japan, and Singapore have proven that they could bring the rate of infection down without a lockdown, without the economy stopping, without the economy pausing, without the economy stalling. They have gone on with a high state of hygiene, high state of public cleanliness, and social distancing being encouraged, and of course quarantining people who are sick and so on. But they haven't stopped the economy. And yet we've seen in each of these countries the curve flatten and the rate of infections go way down. South Korea, fair enough, they received it earlier, but South Korea and Singapore and Japan are good examples of the fact that you don't actually have to shut down the economy in order to fight a virus. And some are arguing that what we're seeing in this country is the destruction of an economy, which is going to hurt the poorest of the poor more, because a healthy economy and a heightened state of investment and investor confidence and more tourism is going to bring about great employment, which will lower the death toll and raise the standard of living of the poorest of the poor, which is most important. Therefore, a lockdown, many economists and health experts are arguing that a lockdown is counterproductive for the purpose of saving lives, that the best way to save lives is to strengthen the economy and lift up everyone's standard of living.
This is true. But then looking again, touching on my earlier question, what would be a better solution for a country like South Africa? You know, not everyone here is on the same page, and we have very different standards of living. In an area like Sweden, them not having a lockdown works well for them, in that they all have a high standard of living from the get-go. But
yes,
what would be a better solution in South Africa?
Right. Well, I think we could be following the Singapore option, because Singapore, it's a small, compact area. I mean, Singapore was actually a bit of an island swamp with no natural resources. They won the independence from Malaysia in 1965, and Singapore has become one of the economic powerhouses of the world, to the extent that we, in our mission, have purchased a lot of our Bibles that we need for Sudan, for example, have been printed in Singapore, because Singapore can print Bibles cheaper and a higher standard of printing, including the shipping costs to get it to Kenya for Sudan. Oh, I mean, it's a tax haven, basically, which is why the economy is booming and unemployment is extremely low, because Singapore has a very high work ethic and a very low tax base. In fact, it's a basic tax haven. It's decentralized, high work ethic, and you just take how they've handled the coronavirus. Right, hygiene, social distancing, quarantining people who are sick. But the economy must go on, because the economy is what's going to pay for everything.
But is that something that is realistic for South Africa?
I do believe it is. Yes, it is.
Even in areas like the townships and the poor communities.
Yes, because the only hope for the millions, the tens of millions in this country unemployed, is great employment. Great employment will raise the standard of living, raise the standard of healthcare, raise the standard of hygiene, raise the level of social distancing options and so on. Therefore, if, for example, if Cape Town was to become a tax haven, if Cape Town was to become decentralized and autonomous, maybe even independent, imagine if Cape Town would follow the economic pattern of Singapore, where things are very decentralized. Now, Singapore, bear in mind, is multi-ethnic, multicultural, multilingual. They have got Chinese, they have got Malayan, they've got European, they've got Christians, they've got Muslims, they've got Buddhists, they've got Hindus, they've got a wide range of variety, but they work together because they're very decentralized, a very high standard of work ethic, and unemployment is virtually unknown because of the fact that you've got so many businesses coming in because they like strict laws, high standards, good work ethic, next to no taxes. Obviously, this attracts people, and suddenly you've got jobs for the millions who would have been unemployed otherwise. So if Cape Town, for example, was to go independent, or if Cape Town was to become a tax haven, what you would do is you'd bring in investors who would create far more employment and therefore would raise the economic standards and lower the unemployment. In every way, this is actually the only way out of it, because the present government, just talking facts now, Cape Town pays 4 times more in tax than it actually receives back in benefits. So, in fact, it's less than that. We receive barely 20% of the taxes we paid are spent back in our area. It's not even that high. It's more like 19%. So what it means is Cape Town is paying 5 times more in tax than we receive. And, of course, a lot of what we receive back is still wasted by BBB, EE, race quotas, government contracts for jobs for the cadres and comrades. And it's so abused that if Cape Town was to declare independence, say, for example, or the whole Western Cape, it would mean you could cut your taxes to 1/5 of what is now.
And we'd be taking an example of Singapore.
Exactly. Well, in fact, if we went further and went into tax haven for Cape Town, for example, we would bring in so much more investment, so many more employers, so many more job creators, that this would boost the situation. But what is the reality? The reality is, for every year that the African National Congress has been in power in the last 25 years, unemployment has increased by 1 million for every year they've been in power. So we had less than 3 million, which was 2.something million unemployed in 1994 when Mandela became president. Today, unemployed, if you count in not just the official unemployed, but also the economically inactive and the discouraged work seekers, which are 3 interesting categories which all mean the same thing.
That is quite a hot topic. But
that's 30 million unemployed now.
But specifically with COVID-19, outside of South Africa, what is happening worldwide in response to this?
Okay, so you've got some places. Let's take United Kingdom, Great Britain, and the United States, where they have got lockdowns, but the lockdowns did not prevent people from taking jogs, going on hikes, going around the park, walking their dog, pushing the pram. They encouraged to stay out of large groups, encouraged not to, maintain good social distancing and so on. But you still have an enormous amount of freedoms taking place there with their lockdown that we don't have here. The lockdown here is so over the top, extreme, unworkable and unenforceable, that it means that it's got to be broken. In fact, most of the people find they have to break it just to survive. And therefore, the situation here is, it won't work. You cannot say, you can't walk the dog. I mean, we had one night, the Minister of Health said, there's no problem taking a jog and walking dog. And the next morning, the Minister of Police says, no walking dog, no taking a jog. Well, if the Minister of Health said it's not a problem, who's the Minister of Police to say it is a problem? And why? For it's obviously not a medical reason to say, could I be infecting anyone or be infected by anyone if I go for a hike up Table Mountain? Mm. Would you infect anyone if you ran around the canal or around a sports field?
Which if anything, you're going into a more opened area, which is safer.
It is. And also, we all need more vitamin D, which has been proven to counteract the virus. We need to get into sunlight. We need to get into fresh air. It's healthy for us. Yeah. And if we don't look after our physical health, we will be at risk of the virus. And we won't recover from any virus, not just COVID-19. But this is not the worst virus out there. There's been a lot more deadly. According to the statistics, this virus could be anything from 0.something% death rate of those who get infected to an extreme high of 3.4%, depending on which area and how they've been dealing with it. But SARS, which was COVID-2, that was a 10% death rate, and MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, that's a 35% to 50% death rate. So this is not the most deadly disease. And people need to bear in mind that actually every year, hundreds of thousands of people die worldwide from normal seasonal flu. Hundreds of thousands. So it's strange that there's been such a paranoia about this, but let's face it, most people would not have been so concerned about this if it hadn't been 24/7 media focus and massive government overreaction to this and all these restrictions. So that many people are so panicked about this. And yet, if you get COVID-19, the odds are you're going to recover from it. Mm. The vast majority of people who have it have mild symptoms. They don't even need to go to a doctor or hospital. Simply vitamin C, fluids, and rest is going to solve
it. It even just leaves your system naturally. It's not as big, but that's one thing that I've noticed about many people of today, especially the younger generation, is they are pro-panic. They are pro whatever the headline story is, whatever the thing is that is going to create panic. But then specifically with common law and the Magna Carta, what happened to that?
Well, in fact, Magna Carta is the first statute, the first written restriction of government, which was particularly instituted in order to restrict the powers of government, to prevent government from being heavy-handed and abusing the power, which, let's face it, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. The more power you give to anyone, the more chance it is that it's going to go to your head. I mean, just think of the Lord of the Rings, the influence of the ring, the one ring that's got the power of all the rings, and it corrupts and it absolutely twists and distorts everyone who comes into touch with it, whether it's Schmeagol and so on. Gollum and even Frodo gets seriously affected. And that's symbolic of power. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. It's not wise to give unlimited power to anyone, any government. And that's why you have Bills of Rights. Magna Carta was there to restrict government. And what's the most important element of freedom, according to our Bills of Rights and Magna Carta? Freedom of worship. Freedom of conscience, freedom of thought, freedom of association, freedom of movement, for goodness sakes.
On that, with freedom of worship, what was the response that happened in Russia?
Well, this is interesting. We often think of Russia as being a very follow the government, obey the government, yes, comrade Communist, kind of government. Yeah. And yet, the Russian Orthodox Church, the patriarch says, you have no right to tell us whether we can gather for worship or not. It is outside of the realm of government to close down church services. We will encourage our worshippers who are sick or old or vulnerable not to come to worship services. We will encourage people to keep social distancing within the church. Nevertheless, you, the government, have no right to tell us whether to close or not. In fact, church services will continue. And so in Russia, despite the government ordering that no service be held, the Russian Orthodox Church and many other denominations have ignored them and expressly told the government, you're overstepping your bounds, you have no right. Now, they've definitely brought down the attendance. They don't want as many people to come to church, but they recognize that it is wrong of the government to ever interfere with this. And they're no longer doing greeting the people with a kiss. They're not shaking everyone's hands at church, but they're still having the worship service. Mm. And it's interesting that the Russian government was resisted by the state church, whereas in America and Britain, we haven't heard much from the churches protesting when they were told, you're not allowed to meet. And it's disturbing when churches allow a government to tell them whether they can meet and under what conditions.
And then specifically with freedom of movements, this is an essential liberty.
It is an essential liberty. And for example, I'm concerned about some of the reports that we've seen and there were cases of media on the streets in Johannesburg filming police and army arriving and starting to shoot around. And the person who was filming, immediately the camera went down. All you could see was on the floor and the person screaming, our media, our media, our media, running into a parking lot. And you could hear somebody's bellowing and screaming at them. This poor woman keeps screaming, our media, our media, you know, what are you doing here? But our media, you know, we meant to be out recording what's going on. And it was just, I'm screaming. Mm. Well, that's totally unacceptable. Here, this person presumably had the normal press identification orders. Media are meant to be allowed to go out. Otherwise, how else can they be sure that the government officials aren't abusing their powers and not abusing the citizens? And so having the media present is actually a safety net. And if even the media are being harassed about being there, you know, you could see in some of these where some police or army officials walking on, put that camera off, you know. Wait a minute. They've got no right to do that. We have freedom of the press, freedom of thought, freedom to protest, freedom of association. All of these freedoms are in the Bill of Rights. And it's extremely dangerous for government to have the right to say, this is, now they can't say there's a matter of national security, because we don't have some enemy on the border threatening to invade us. But now they've declared this pandemic a threat to national security. In fact, the president said it's the greatest threat to our democracy in history. And because they've now declared a disease the greatest threat, somehow it means that they think that they can now suspend the Bill of Rights, even though the Bill of Rights in no way allows for that. And what's also disturbing is hearing in the president's speech just last night, he's talking about mobilizing 10,000 health workers, whatever that means, to go house to house to test everyone. Now, wait a minute. Just think about that. We've got in our Bill of Rights also that nobody should be forced to do medical testing or have scientific testing on them without their informed consent. And so if you don't want to consent, you should not be forced to do this. But what about the security of your home? Here's somebody, you've been told to stay in seclusion, isolation, quarantine, however they want to call it. Now, this health worker, say he tests 100 people a day. What's the chances, considering it takes 2 weeks for the symptoms to develop, but they're contagious during the time, that the health worker could be spreading the disease, coming house to house? This is ill thought out, and it's extremely dangerous. And since when does a government have a right to come to every door and say, you've got to take this test? The chance of this spreading the disease is bad, but the implications for personal liberty, it seems that we are now replacing, instead of healthcare, we now have health scare. And instead of a pandemic, we've got a panic epidemic. And instead of a government that's seeking to protect us, we've got a government that's trying to rule us and dominate us and keep us under house arrest. And effectively, they're not using this word, but it's martial law. Because when you've got the army running around the streets, you're not allowed to leave your house. That used to be called martial law. And I'm not aware that martial law has been declared. I'm not sure what right, in accordance with our constitution, the president has to mobilize soldiers throughout the population when we don't even have a war, we don't have an attack. What is the reason to have soldiers in suburbs and going around people's homes? So the implications for freedom are serious, and we may find that what we're doing is giving more power to government and trading away our essential freedoms and liberties in exchange for promises, which may or may not materialize, of some more safety from some epidemic, which may or may not turn out to be as bad as they're saying. But I'm concerned what happens when people are trusting a media that are almost in chorus screaming the same things. And there's a few discordant questioning voices saying, well, what about 5G? Well, is this really the most deadly epidemic? Is this the most dangerous? Is this the best way to deal with? Well, what about Singapore, Sweden, South Korea, and Japan? What about these excesses? And then they shout it down. You're not allowed to say this. And we've heard the police, minister of police in this country actually say, when he's questioned about abuses, he says, you've seen nothing yet. There's going to be a lot more abuses. And he said, I'm talking about police brutality. He says, you've seen nothing yet. There's more police brutality coming. And again, is this being directed against mobsters, gangs, drug dealers, murderers?
Or normal law-abiding citizens.
And in some cases, somebody who decided to try and surf in Durban beachfront. And next thing, they're arrested and imprisoned. And you've got people being slapped with 5,000 rand fines and 50,000 rand fines. And it's insane. This is not the greatest threat that our democracy's faced. I would have thought the greatest threat our democracy's faced is corruption. According to the African Union Task Force on Corruption, one third, 32% of the GDP, gross domestic product, is stolen through corruption, government corruption. And it's not talking about inflation, which is a hidden tax. It's not talking about taxation, just talking about corruption. We're talking about trillions of rands are stolen every year by government corruption. Now, isn't government corruption the greatest threat? A lot of people are very pleased that our president promised to deal with corruption when he came to power 2 years ago. But can anyone point to one prosecution, one firing of one corrupt official? We can point to quite a lot of being reappointed into cabinet positions, even of proven corrupt individuals. So has anything actually been done about the corruption? What's been recovered of all the billions that were stolen from Eskom, SAA, and so on? But what about murder? What about farm murders? What about abortion? What about so many other matters of crime in this country? What about car accidents that kill over 25,000 a year? We have 25,000 people being murdered every year. What about all farm murders? Well, over 4,000 farmers and their family members murdered in torturous ways. are those not threats to our national security even greater than the coronavirus? So I'm all for hygiene, and I'm all for everything we can do to limit and to counteract the effects of disease, and we want to be responsible, and we've encouraged that, to understand how the coronavirus spreads, what we can do to prevent it, how to recognize the symptoms. That's important. But it's more important to fight corruption, which is killing this whole country and the economy.
Now, moving forward, what are things that we as Christians and we as South Africans, even other people in the world, what can we do to deal with this in a godly manner? And what do you think is going to be the outcome of this?
Well, I can tell you what I would like to be the outcome. I would like to see spiritual revival, because as people are restricted in their freedoms and not allowed to move as much as before, I hope that we'll see a lot of people getting back to the Bible, getting back to the family, getting back to reading, getting back to praying, because we may be restricted, but the Spirit of God's not restricted. The Word of God's not restricted. There's power in prayer, and the Word of God is powerful and effective. As people are confined to homes and we no longer are spending time commuting and traveling, well, can we redeem the time by doing a lot more Bible study, prayer time, including with the family? Can we invest more in our minds and reading? The emphasis on physical hygiene is a good thing. In fact, I've been deeply disturbed at the deterioration of hygiene. And so this encouraging of greater hygiene, let's go with that. That's excellent. We really need to do a lot more hygiene and emphasis on it. But what about mental hygiene? The ideological diseases are more dangerous than the physical diseases. Just take, for example, COVID-19 came out of China. COVID-19 has killed something in the region of 35,000 people, perhaps, worldwide so far. And yet, communism killed 69 million Chinese people and another 100 million around the world in the 20th century. So communism has proved to be a vastly more deadly ideological disease, mental disease, than COVID-19 is ever likely to be in a worst nightmare scenario. And there's so many serious ideological diseases. Secular humanism, I'd put in the same category. But what about spiritual diseases? In fact, we've written a whole article on spiritual diseases and their cure. But then there's emotional diseases. You cannot expect to be a happy, balanced person, body, mind, and spirit, if you listen to angry rap, hip-hop, death metal, rock and rap. All of this sort of thing is going to disturb you. There's a reason why they don't play that sort of music on aircraft, because people are already a bit disturbed flying, so they normally have more soothing classical type music in the background on aircraft. If you watch horror films, if you have ugly, violent art, if you are allowing angry type of music or noise around you, it's going to affect you emotionally. So we need to think of hygiene, not just body, but also mind and spirit and soul. And we are spiritual beings, and it's seriously important for us to regard everything we read, everything we watch, everything we, the websites we choose to go on, the emails we subscribe to, the different art we are putting up around our home. Let's really work on improving our hygiene in every area. To detox physically is good. Well, let's try and detox spiritually, emotionally, and mentally as well. And I would hope that out of this will come a great revival as people go back to God, go back to the knees, where the fear of death of this disease could lead people not to trust in the government and the World Health Organization, the UN, but to trust more the problem than the solution, but to go back to God and back to the Bible. That would be my hope, that people would come out of this with stronger families, having invested in the education of their children, because it's probably a good thing that the children aren't getting indoctrinated in the local school, especially when you think of this comprehensive sexuality education, pornography indoctrination, and a lot of other bad things that happen there. We've believed in homeschooling in our family for decades, and I'd hope many people discover how workable homeschooling is. So there's a lot of good resources online. I'd hope we make use of them. But my concern is that people will not be going back to God and back to the Bible, but be sitting glued to their TV screens, watching the panic being broadcast by the Clinton News Network, the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation, Slime Magazine, Useless News and World Report, Newspeak, and these other New World Order mouthpieces for indoctrination. We've got to really be careful. If we've been given an opportunity to reorientate our lives in this enforced quarantine, if we spend our time watching what the world's panic-mongering machine is telling us, then you're going to be more disturbed and more fearful and come out of it spiritually impoverished. So we've got a choice. You can go with the world's panic pandemic, or you can get back to the Bible, get back to the Word of God, get back to real education, real books, classic materials, and come out of this physically, spiritually, mentally, and emotionally stronger by using this as a time to clean out, sort out, fix up, and do those projects at home and in your reading that you didn't have time to do before.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for your time, and we pray that everyone who is tuned in will stay safe. God bless, and stay safe.